Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by SeeRadioDifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows. In this week's podcast, I've been on the road. But first, I speak with Mumbrella Managing Editor Robin Hicks about Kangaroo Island's Cash for Tweets story. And a little bit later, I sat down with the team behind the conversation, plus the return of MasterChef. This week saw a great campaign for Kangaroo Island, marred when the South Australian Tourism Commission campaign became embroiled in a cash for tweet controversy by a number of celebrities, including pub rocker cum dancing star Shannon Null and Ten celebrity chef Matt Moran. Now, Robin, this is one that you wrote after what I think journalists would refer to as a good get in a Media Watch segment on the ABC. Maybe explain further.
Yeah, so the story was based on, obviously, a Media Watch finding. They discovered that three celebrities in particular, Matt Moran, Sophie Faulkner and Shannon Null, had been tweeting on behalf of Kangaroo Island. Now, the marketing director of South Australian Tourism Commission, David O'Loughlin, he admitted this to Media Watch, and he even sent them three examples.
Yeah, he really did want to get busted, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he was just like, he was almost revelling in the fact that they'd been discovered, and quite openly said, yes, we've done this, we're not, and I spoke to the agency as well, KWP from Adelaide, and John Baker, one of the managing partners there, and who said, it's not illegal. What we're doing goes back hundreds of years. So what celebrities have always been paid to endorse products. What we're doing is no different from Paris Hilton and walking around with a Gucci handbag.
Do you know,
she doesn't have to declare to anyone that she was paid to have that handbag or show off that handbag in public.
Do you know, my issue is more with the celebs than with the agency or with the organisation, because it's about their trust with their followers. So in other words, you know, are they ethically obliged to tell people that they're being paid to tweet and that maybe they haven't even, you know, because I think in some cases they're suggesting they haven't even been there. So should they tell their followers, you know, is there a trust thing? So it's not about the ad agency doing anything wrong, it's whether the celebrity is just, you know, are morally obliged to do so.
Yeah, true. The agency was very clear. They said that the celebrities were not instructed exactly on what to say. They were told absolutely not to lie. So if they hadn't been to Kangaroo Island, they couldn't say that they had. And if they didn't,
they could say they were thinking about Kangaroo Island,
yes,
for instance.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. But yeah, no, the Media Watch story was based on an email we had from a publicist, and I'll just read this out. I have been contacted by South Australian Tourism, and they are looking for high-profile celebrities with a high Twitter following to tweet about Kangaroo Island. They will pay $750 plus GST for one tweet. They don't want to tweet to appear endorsed rather than an organic mention, injecting your own personality into the tweet.
In other words, don't disclose that you're being paid. The other thing, $750 seems pretty cheap to sell your credibility, which is what I think it is, really.
It's ridiculously cheap, isn't it? And I think the next point is, you know, they've said it's illegal. They've said it's not illegal. But very quickly after they told me that, they said, as far as we know, which is very important. I remember you asking me to chase the legality of that, and I spoke to a lawyer, Stephen von Munster, and he quoted two parts of Australian consumer law, Section 18, I think Section 8 it was, that could appear that what they're doing is misleading advertising. So I think this story is far from over.
And interesting, seeing similar things happen in the UK as well, where Snickers did it with, they got Jordan and I forget who the other celebrity was to tweet all these super intelligent things about, you know, the kind of the situation in the Middle East or the exchange rate mechanism, because, you know, they're famously kind of airheaded. And then the final message was, because it was over a number of tweets, was, you're not you when you're hungry, Snickers. Which created some outrage, great campaign. But the thing that led to them being cleared by the ad standards watchdog was that in the final tweet they had hashtag, and I can't remember if it was hashtag ad or hashtag promo, but they actually did declare it. And in the end, the equivalent of the Ad Standards Bureau, which is, I think, the Ad Standards Commission, is it, in the UK? I forget what it is, but they cleared them on the grounds that they declared it in the final tweet, which obviously they didn't in this case.
That's where I think Kangaroo Island could come unstuck. It's all about context. If it's not declared, if it's not clear that it's an ad, it's not clear that the celebrities are endorsing this, then they could run into hot water.
Next, a conversation about the conversation.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone All-Time Prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
This week I was in the Melbourne headquarters of the team behind The Conversation. That's the website that runs analysis and commentary on news and current affairs, and it's driven from the university and research sector. Now, I talked to them about the concept behind the site as a new type of journalism, the transition from editing the likes of The Age and London's The Observer to founding a digital startup, and just why they do need so many web techs. Sitting with me at the table was Lisa Watts, the commercial director, Misha Ketchell, managing editor, and Andrew Jasmine, the founder.
Andrew, I actually find it quite hard to believe it's been a year already, because it feels like the conversation just sort of popped up yesterday. How has it gone from your point of view?
Well, I think when you and I first met in Brisbane, I think we'd been going just 6 months then, and it was probably too early to see how it was going, but we were really excited by the fact that in those days we were getting something like 3,000 or 4,000 visits to the site a day. It's now jumped up to sort of between 20 and 25, although the measure we use is the monthly visits, which is more around sort of 350 mark. And in a sense, there's sort of lots of different ways of measuring success and how we're doing. A critical one for us, though, is to deliver the largest possible audience to our writers, to our authors, who are all registered or accredited academics with either a university. We have CSIRO as well, and we also work with research institutes. So the short answer is that we've delivered a pretty big audience over the year, 2.5 million visitors to the site, unique visitors to the site over a year, and you know, something like nearly 9 million page impressions over the year. So we had no idea when we started. Usually when you start a business, and we're a not-for-profit business, you set up a bunch of KPIs. You know, we're going to attain this, that, and the other. We had no idea. Mm. So we still don't know if what we're doing is good or not. You might be a better judge of that. But we only feel that we're just getting into our stride.
So, well, let's tackle a couple of the questions that came.
How old is Crikey now, Misha?
About 13 or 14 years.
Yeah. And so we're now at almost, I think, about, what, half or two-thirds their audience?
Something like that. Like,
yeah, in a year. And we're, as I say, we really feel we're only just now beginning to get the name out.
Well, you recently wrote a guest post for us about that one-year anniversary. Now, it's probably worth tackling a couple of the questions that came up in the comment thread,
yeah.
One of which is almost a kind of jealous voice of what amazing resources you have with your six tech staff and all of those things.
Yeah.
A lot of kind of independent media sites, they're based on things like WordPress, and that's what Mumbrella's on, for instance, where pretty much for $100 you can start.
Yeah.
You took a very different approach. You know, you've gone for a kind of bespoke build. What's the strategy behind that?
Look, just before I answer that, I just wanted to say one thing, which is that what I find interesting is most of the players who are commenting on the way we do things are, if you like, established players. And we've come into the market in quite a different way. So they can't quite, they're working out our model against their model, and they just can't understand it. So in terms of the platform, we saw this site as being two things, really, about great content, but about a new way of engaging in the digital space. And we do something very different to any other website. So the critical thing for us is every author needs to know a couple of things. First of all, how to write. So we built an interface from scratch using something called the Flesch-Kincaid logarithm, which actually we've adapted and changed, which helps them write at the average age of a good well-educated 16-year-old. So the first thing was we had to build a different way of working, which we call a collaborative writing
platform. And this algorithm covers things like how long each sentence is, how many syllables in each word,
correct,
things like that.
Yeah, the complexity of the language, all that sort of thing. So it's and it has a traffic light system, so it's red if it's, you know, if it's you're writing at, you know, at an age way above where we want to be. And the reason we pitched it as 16-year-old is important is that this is a public-facing consumer website of trusted content. It is not academic to academic. It is not a scientific journal, learned journal. It's literally just like any other media play, but the authors are people who are knowledgeable about this subject or have deep subject matter expertise. So you can only write on a subject that you know something about. So the days of writing or making stuff up as you go along in terms of our site are over. Well, they never existed, but that's the different play we've got. So that's the first thing. The second thing is every author who writes for us gets an individual dashboard, which tells them how many people read their articles, how many people have commented, how many people have tweeted or Facebook liked them, and also where else it's being republished, because we operate under Creative Commons, so we allow our copy to be free and used by anyone as long as they abide by a couple of conventions. One of them is that you don't rewrite anything. And lastly, they also know where people are reading them. So we actually give them, you know, a graph which tells them which countries they're being read and so on and so forth. Now, the reason that's all important is that right now, and it's going to become increasingly the case, every academic is going to be asked at the end of each year, what did you do in terms of the third bit of a university's responsibility? Is public engagement, the first two being teaching and research. So teaching, research, and public engagement, which means sharing your knowledge, your research, making sure the public actually have access and know what's going on, becomes a much more important part of an academic's responsibility. And we give them the tool to demonstrate that.
And in order to use that tool, you had to build that tool because it didn't exist
correct
before.
So we actually, there's a mantra, do you buy or build, and we went through that whole exercise. We looked at three content management systems. They were all way too expensive for us, and each one of them needed to be customized in a way that actually was going to cost sort of double the cost. So you bought, you know, the basic thing, customized it out, and frankly we just thought none of them would do what we wanted. Also, we didn't have control over it, so we decided instead of doing that to build it from scratch, we have six developers who built something which now we own, we can control, we can manage, we can develop whichever we want, and in time we'll let others also use that platform. We're not quite ready. But the critical thing is we are not just, as you say, a WordPress where you can just easily, very quickly have a right to entry in the market where you just buy WordPress for, I don't know, it's $100 or whatever it is, and bingo, off you go. This is much more complex because we have that other important secondary role, which is to deliver value back to our funders, which is the universities.
Now, Misha, you take responsibility for the day-to-day, making sure the stuff actually goes on the site. What typically is the process of your day?
We start the day with an editorial meeting each day at about 9 o'clock, and we discuss the issues of the day. So, for example, we were talking this morning about the Peter Slipper saga, and, you know, what issues that raises in terms of parliamentary conventions. And what we do generally is each section editor will report in and we'll talk about stories in their area and we'll look at stories we're going to commission from academics. When Andrew and Jack were starting this project, a lot of people said to them that academics wouldn't be able to write quickly, they wouldn't be able to write for a general audience. And that's not been what we've found at all. We can commission a story coming out of that meeting at about 10 a.m. and we can have it up within an hour or 2 hours, sometimes, depending on the story.
And depending on the academic's willingness,
that's
I guess,
right,
as well.
So part of what we do is we get academics involved in public issues. So when Fukushima happens, we get an expert writing about the impact of radiation on the body. There was a story on the front page of The Australian today about GST. We're commissioning an explainer about the Australian tax system and where the different taxes come from and how they divide up. So it's providing a service to a reader and shedding light on issues in the news. That's a portion of what we do. But another big portion is actually finding out the most interesting things academics are doing and
In terms of research?
Particularly in terms of research and making sure that those stories get out to people.
And is there some competition with the peer-reviewed journals, for instance, when there's a piece of research? Because I guess everyone wants to be the first one to report the research.
No, we're not a peer-reviewed journal in that we have a team of journalists who can help academics polish their prose, write in a clear way, put a good headline and a good picture on a piece. But really, the academics are writing for a general readership about their research that they might publish in a peer-reviewed journal. They might link to that piece. But generally, it's a slightly different type of publication.
For you, you were at the ABC before, working with the Media Watch programme. This is, I guess, public service journalism of a different type. Was there much of a transition to make?
Look, not really. I mean, it was interesting. At Media Watch, one of the things I constantly noticed was that experts were getting frustrated with the way they were being quoted in the media and the way they were being treated. And one thing that with the interface that we've built, is that when an academic writes a piece for us, they get final sign-off. So what we've done is provide a safe publishing environment so that people who are actually experts who know about issues in the news can talk about them in a way that they're comfortable dealing with the media, they're comfortable going out to a wider audience, and they know that they're not going to be misquoted or misrepresented. So in a way, this was natural for me because every day at Media Watch, I was looking at people getting it wrong. I was looking at people getting frustrated, and I was often working with academics to correct misinformation in the media. And you know, what better way to actually deal with that problem than rather than correcting the errors, stop them happening in the first place.
And Lisa, yours is a commercial role. Up to now, I guess we haven't seen much commercialisation. You know, apart from perhaps around the edges of the conversation. Mm. How are you going to be driving that?
Yes, it's interesting because there's been quite a lot of activity and we've got some very strong supporters. It's just that the way in which they leverage their support is not visible to the reader in the sense of a traditional advertising
model. There aren't ads everywhere.
Correct, yeah. And, you know, we've done, last month we did a big reader survey. We had 2,000 respondents and people value that. They value the fact that not only do we say that we're commercially independent, that there's evidence of that or lack of evidence of the other. So it's a good thing.
The job board is a recent development.
It is, yeah. So we've had that's been launched about just before Christmas, and it's really at the moment a place where a lot of our partners who fund us, so we've got some sort of very strong relationships with some universities, and they put all their ads up on there. So it's a benefit of being a supporter to some extent. But we also have other roles that are about sort of thought leadership, expertise, sort of jobs for experts is how we're pitching it.
And that's a potential revenue driver.
It is, yeah. So our view is that the proposition as it keeps growing will be so compelling that all universities will become funding members, and that's definitely happening. We've had, since we introduced the idea of sort of more of them coming on board and paying a fee each year, we've had another 9 sign up since late last year. But we'll probably get everyone, we think, over the next couple of years. But at the moment, those who don't pay a membership fee to us quite often will spend money putting ads on the site as well for jobs.
Now, I'm just going to just jump in if you don't mind. What's really exciting about our model is nobody's actually done it before, as we said, you know, the service, but the funding is quite different as well. So traditionally, websites are funded through really either paywalls, which have been introduced now, or through advertising. If you take ProPublica in the US, that's funded through a huge philanthropic grant, $25 million to get it going, from the Sandlers. If you look at TED.com, that has some very big corporates who, in a sense, are sponsors of the site as well. There's a new site here, Global Mail, which was, again, a philanthropic donation.
This was Graham Wood, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Oh, I can't remember, but a huge amount of money as well.
Yeah, sort of, I think, 4 or 5 million a year or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
for I think 5 years. I think it's sort of, you know, 25 million or whatever it is over the period. Ours is quite different, which is the only one I know where universities are largely speaking the funders of it. We also get a little bit of corporate money, a little bit of startup money from the government as well. but largely two-thirds of our funding, and it's also growing. So Lisa and I just yesterday got another university partner to join us. So it's a growing list. So it's quite a different model that we've got.
Now, my sense with Global Mail is that maybe they're not having that much impact yet. I don't see stuff being shared that much yet. If that's a fair observation, where do you think they're going wrong? What should they be doing that maybe they're not yet?
I don't think we're in a position to comment or to give lessons. You know, we're really not there. Look, I don't really know what their numbers are, but, you know, good luck to them. I mean, as far as we're concerned, you know, we're just keen to see as many different players enter this market. We're running an interview with Graham Samuel. He was saying that he was looking, his sort of favourite sites now, as he claims, are ourselves and Business Spectator. Now, he was saying that he thought in time a combination of Conversation and Business Spectator might have an audience as big as, you know, some of the other, you know, traditional mainstream media players, as it were. And, you know, I'd like to see more entries into this area. I mean, the key problem with Australia is the lack of variety and choice when it comes to different points of view. Although there are lots of voices out there, they're actually all controlled by two groups, you know, News Limited and Fairfax. And to me, somebody who's spent most of their working life in the UK, where, you know, you have, you know, 15 newspapers with their websites, you've got a lot more players there. And what we believe in is, you know, let 100 flowers bloom. That's really what we want to see. We want to see more voices. And again, the difference, I guess, between ourselves, the Global Mail, the only point I would make, is that they are using established journalists to write for them, whereas we do not do that, as I said to you earlier. We only allow academics and researchers to come in. And what we're doing, in a sense, is bringing new talent and new voices for people to engage with and read. But also, I think, I don't know if you made this point, Lisa, that in the survey we recently did, we found 40% of all our authors were then being picked up by the media, which is radio, TV, online, newspapers, to do even more. So we've actually brought in, if you like, new voices, new talent, new ideas, new thinking. And at the end of the day, what we're about is better public discourse or better conversations.
And just on the global, final question on the Global Mail, as you mentioned...
You're really insistent on this.
Well, as much as I think it's the way you all smiled and looked at each other when I first raised it.
Why have we got video?
But I suppose my question is you know, as you say, we haven't seen many numbers from them yet.
Yeah.
Would you like to see a little bit more transparency from them? Well, because I guess a lot of people are out there learning at the moment and doing different things.
I think the name of the game now is transparency. And we put a really high commitment to that in terms of there's a disclosure on every author where their funding comes from, a disclosure about what they actually know about a subject. Because a lot of people... I don't know about you, but quite often I read an op-ed column and it just says at the end, you know, so-and-so is a Sydney writer or a Melbourne writer. And I think, well, why should I read that person? What do they actually know about the subject? Or, more importantly, you see something and what you fail to understand is that person actually works for a lobbying outfit or political party, or political parties they tend to disclose. But, you know, it might be, you know, they work for a tobacco company, and you don't know that because it's not disclosed there. The idea is to just get your point of view into the public arena, into that space. We have disclosure there. We're also very open about our readership and about where it's coming from, etc. And I think that if you set yourself up with those kind of high principles, it must flow through to everything you do.
Now, how ambitious are you for the Conversation? And I guess what I mean by that is you've edited a couple of the world's great newspaper titles. Do you see the Conversation being talked about in the same way as the, you know, the mastheads that you've worked in from the traditional media in time?
I don't really know how to answer that, because there is a lot of interest in what we're doing, particularly in the US and UK, as you can imagine, and I still have a pretty big network, particularly in the UK. Something that we sort of will look at in time is, you know, whether we should open this up elsewhere. But we're not ready to do that. I think we're at the stage now of just trying to make sure what we do here we do well. And let me tell you, there is, you know, all three of us here are so challenged to just, you know, do what we're trying to do, that the idea of doing much more is pretty inconceivable from this team. But, you know, there are others who are saying, you know, to me, saying, you know, this is a great model, we should look at it. And that's something we'll look at, you know, as and when.
And for you, what's the experience like compared to the Scotsman, the age? This must feel like a small team to you, I suppose.
You know, there's a couple of things that, first of all, it's actually quite similar in many ways. So the way that Mish and I run the newsroom is no different to the way I would have run the age. You know, we start off with a conference. It's an ideas conference. It's an ideas development conference in the sense that, you know, somebody would say, what about this? And somebody would say, well, what about looking at it like that? And so on and so forth. So that's no different to any media organization. But fundamentally, what I love about this is all my energies and Mish's energies go into ideas. Whereas when I was at The Age or other newspapers, I spent a huge amount of my time worrying about the manufacturing process of getting the paper out. So it would look great on the screen, and then you press a button and the problems would start. You know, the printing presses wouldn't work, or they were printing, there was too much ink and the pictures didn't print well, or you had a web break, the trucks then were late, the news agents got it late, the delivery boy or girl was sick that day, and it goes on and on, and all that nonsense, right, has gone, and I'm just so delighted that's behind me, because that's, you know, people confuse constantly. They say, oh, newspapers are fading, that means journalism's fading, as though the two are synonymous. They're not. Newspapers are just a delivery mechanism invented sort of 160, 70 years ago. It was the penny papers was just the cheapest way of getting information out. Roll on to now, the cheapest way to get information out is just, you know, through the web.
You mentioned in your guest post for us, Fairfax, you've obviously got newspapers, you've got digital, and for a long time...
By the way, I just wanted to finish on one last thing, which is, it's a really, something I reflect on a lot. When I was at The Observer, we had a full-time staff of 75, plus about, I don't know, 100 contributors or whatever. At The Scotsman, I had a full-time staff of about 120, with not so many contributors. At The Age, we had a staff of about 325 staff with lots of other contributors. And my last paper I worked on, Sunday Herald, we had a staff of 35 with lots of contributors. Here we're down to an editorial team of 15.
Yeah, 15.
And I actually, the one thing I've realised is I actually like smaller teams, because I just couldn't remember the names of everybody at The Age, didn't know what they were doing. So I, from a journalistic professional point of view, this is probably the most fulfilling project I've done as an editor, as a journalist. And, you know, Mish and I are just really lucky that we've managed, well, I was lucky to get Mish to join, but we were lucky to get such a great team as well, because everybody out there, we only wanted them to join if they were excited by the project, you know. It was all about saying, do you know what? That's what I really want to go into journalism to do. I've tried other things, but this is really accords with the kind of journalism I'd like to do. Do you want to add to that, Misha?
No, I think that's absolutely right. It's really about, you know, and there's no place in journalism where you have more freedom to pursue ideas than in a role like this. I mean, this is, you know, as Andrew was saying before, it's purely about trying to contribute to public debate, develop ideas, and that's a real luxury. I mean, you know, in any newspaper you work on, there's a certain amount of reporting the shipping times or doing, you know, the basic court reporting, and it's a different model. And just actually one other thing that's important to note about that, when people talk about our staff numbers, the number of editors we have, it is a fundamentally different model. So all of our editors are not editors in the traditional sense of editors who are working with professional journalists who are filing copy. They're editors who are working collaboratively with academic authors who, with whom they have relationships, which are sort of, you know, need more, they're more complicated relationships than they would be if you're just saying, you know, go out and cover that particular
story. Yes, I wonder if it's more like the relationship that a publisher would have with a book author rather than
That's right, yeah. And it's very much about relationships. I mean, we're there to help the authors. The role really is to help them get their ideas across and to discover their ideas. And it is a slightly different role to sort of traditional.
The other thing is we work with 39 universities, and every section, we have five sections. If you take science and technology, we have two people on that section. Now, I think to try and cover the entire 39 universities, plus CSIRO, plus the research institutes, with two people to do science and technology is, you know, a stretch. I reckon if we had four, it would still be a stretch. But you could have two people on science and two on technology. So in other words, to do our job well, and that's important, because if we don't do our job well, our partners, and that's our model, will say, do you know what, it's a really shallow service. It's slow. You only put up two stories a week. There's very little traffic. What's the point? You know, this is a game changer. This is where we've gone in with, you know, frankly, a critical mass, which we had to do. We had to say, okay, we're going to be serious. We're going to have 15 editors, and they're good editors. And we're going to build a website which is at industry best standards, if not better. It's cutting edge. And if we do something like that, we just want people to say, do you know what? That is different. You know, and fundamentally, that's what we want people to know, that what we're doing is different, but our values are pretty traditional in the sense that we just want to arrive at journalism you can trust. That's really our goal and aim: responsible, ethical, trusted journalism.
And jumping back to the guest post you wrote for us again. So one of the things you mentioned there was Fairfax. At the time you were there,
funny you should
digital,
pick on that.
Digital on one side of the divide, print the other,
yeah.
And the two not encouraged to collaborate, yeah. Really. And I think that the line you used was that you know, now that's changed, but maybe it's too late.
Yeah.
What did you mean by too late?
Well, look, the web came into its own in terms of newspapers when licenses were changed around 1995. And around that period, that's when The Age started and a couple of others. But at that time, I was editing The Observer in London. And Peter Beaumont was our web editor. And I remember, you know, he ran it, very excited. And I just thought, wow, this is new and different. And we put a lot of effort. That's 1995. I then launched a paper in 1999, which was, I always call it, the last paper of the 20th century. But it was six sections. Five were printed, the sixth was digital. And the beauty of it was, is it blew open that restriction that you could only publish once a week on Sunday, because the digital section was live all week. So we had debates running all week. There was the big thing that we did was to introduce, you know, we'd set up arguments on a Sunday, say, what do you think? And bang, there'd be debate throughout the week. That's 1999. Then I came here in 2004 to The Age and was told, no, you don't have anything to do with digital, because not only does it not fall under you, it doesn't even belong. It's a different company. There's Fairfax Digital, and there's Fairfax, I didn't know what it was called. It's called some other company, Fairfax. It's called Publishing, despite the fact that publishing is what you do digitally as well. But anyway, so they didn't even know what they were, and there was real confusion. Part of the reason was it was being run by CEOs who are what I call jobbing CEOs. You know, they moved around from I don't know, running a consultancy business to running, you know, whatever business. In the case of David Kirk, he was, you know, he'd run a paper company. He'd been, I think, in financial services. He'd also been at McKinsey. And, of course, he was a world-famous rugby player. But he didn't fundamentally know about our business, right? And that has gone on all along until now. So to your point, at the beginning of this year, Greg Highwood was appointed as the CEO. The first time, as far as I can see, that Fairfax has appointed a journalist, somebody who actually has, the old saying is, ink running through their veins, running the place, which means, by the way, that journalist will address and approach every problem on the basis of, well, is this good for journalism or not? And that's the key test. Now, News Limited has that. So John Hardigan famously had that. Kim is a different beast, Kim Williams, the new CEO.
But John paid content is running through his veins.
Digital pass.
But I was fascinated by the fact that the board had the guts to employ somebody at long last who is smart, knows the space, is willing to experiment and be brave and do a whole bunch of things. And he's now, just now, and there's a project going on at this very moment to integrate print and digital, as they call it. And this is, it's a false dichotomy, by the way. They call print as though print is, you know, content. It's all content, you know. And it's just the delivery mechanism. So it's just bringing together, if you like, the journalists who worked on the print side and the digital side together, which is the right thing to do. Otherwise, you have an us and a them approach. But they've got some big issues to address. For example, the values and the pitch of their websites is quite different to the newspapers. You know, this hasn't been addressed. And when I tried to get into that debate, I was told just to back off. Now, I'm delighted that the editors are now re-engaging. And to answer your question, sorry, I tend to be a bit long-winded. Is it too late? I don't know. I'm glad they're getting around to it, but I really worry that this space is moving so fast. And I think they've confused their readership. So a lot of people who read SMH or The Age in the paper then go to the website and say it's something quite different. And by the way, that's not different by accident, it's by design. The idea was to go for a much broader audience. Stretching the brand is the word that they used internally. And what you do by doing that is you actually go head-to-head with the Daily Telegraph's online offering or the Herald Sun's. And people who wanted to have that sort of informed, quality market journalism are actually feeling locked out. Now, whether they can bring them back in, I guess they will, and I hope they will. I mean, I really do wish them well on this. But they really have to be really serious about it. If they get it right, I think there's a real possibility that they'll lock in the most important audience, which is the audience that obviously spends money, consumes, and therefore supports the advertising, which is, their sort of business model.
Now, Lisa, changing the subject slightly, you're obviously responsible for guaranteeing the long-term revenues. Is your sense, now that the model is established and out there, that you will continue to get the support of the institutions, and this isn't a two-year project, it is something that will sustain itself?
Yes, there's definitely... there's a sense that what we've seen so far needs to be here. It's a very passionate readership, for one thing, and I've never worked somewhere before where the readers have been so sort of at first grateful, and now perhaps in terms of, they feel very engaged and connected to the process. So it's a real growing community, and I think that's a real asset from a commercial point of view in terms of sustainability. You've got people who really care about its ongoing health, as do the university members as well. The web developers develop, they're all Ruby on Rails, they develop in an agile methodology. It's lots of iterations and it's not experimental all the time, but very fluid ways of making decisions. And to some extent, that's the way we manage the business and treat our sort of commercial operations as well. So we're testing out things, we're trying things out, we're asking a lot of advice, we're having a pilot of this, and I'm sure that the end game in a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years will probably be quite different from what's in our minds today. But we will have a big and growing engaged audience, and we will be delivering all this fantastic value to our university partners. Those two things are... But that's working. The rest of it, we'll figure out around the edges.
And Misha, this is a new type of journalism. Staff who come and work for you, what skills do they need that are maybe different to traditional skills?
Well, it's... In a way, almost all our staff are, in some sense, equivalent to what would have been, say, an op-ed editor on a traditional newspaper, in that what they need to do is be able to be across a news agenda and a range of issues, to be able to pick out the big themes and the big issues, and then find the right people to write and work with them on their prose. So it's actually, in some sense, quite a senior role, in that it requires a lot of relationship management, a lot of collaboration. And really, more than anything else, I think Andrew put his finger on it before, it's editorial creativity. It's actually about looking at a story and seeing what a reader would want, what would actually help a reader get across an issue or start to understand it, or would make their life richer. So it's sort of a very creative set of skills. And it's not a set of skills you necessarily get in somebody who's straight out of journalism school. You can, but it really depends on the person.
Also, in terms of story origination, they sort of divide at present. I think it'll change more. We initially, because we're new, we had to really sort of say, these are the kind of stories we'd like, and ask and commission. But we also have a lot of people pitching ideas to us. So increasingly, we're getting more and more of those. And the stories that are pitched quite often are, I'm doing this interesting piece of research. Would you be interested in looking, doing an aspect of it? Now, you mentioned before academic journals. I think academic journals' days are numbered. I think, it's an old model. It was a slow model. It took forever for you to send an idea in. Then the academic journal would write back and say, yes, we're interested. Send your thing in. Then it was peer reviewed. And all this could take a year. So the actual thought and idea and creative project was done here. A year later, it's published. And people saying, no, we want to speed up. The internet's come along. During that year, I've actually spoken about this idea at 12 conferences already. I've emailed all my friends. Everybody knows about it. So when it comes out, it's just old news. So the model is completely changing. And I think the area we're in now, where people are saying, I want to tell the world about what I'm doing, and I want the world to share what I'm doing. And also, by the way, I want to collaborate with others interested in this space. So we now have got lots of examples where an academic does something here, somebody in India gets in touch and saying, I'm really interested in what you're doing on water harvesting. We've never heard anybody do it that way. Could we work together on that? Or on food security issues, or whatever it is. You know, we're building up, because as you know, when you publish on the internet, the information is shared globally. We're building up a global knowledge network. And that's really an exciting space. But the key point I just want to make to Misha is that we don't come up with all the ideas. We have what we call a virtual newsroom of 2,700 authors now, plus the 15 editors here, which makes us, by the way, I think probably the largest virtual newsroom in Australia.
And speaking of real newsrooms, by the looks of it, through the glass, I can see that what must be the staff conference is getting underway. So this is probably a good time to stop. So Andrew, Misha, Lisa, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Next, MasterChef Series 4.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone All-Time Prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
So Tim, you're in Melbourne to cover the launch of the fourth series of MasterChef. How does it look?
Pretty good. I must say though, Channel 10 always do really good sizzle reels, so it's kind of hard to tell. One difference for the launch event this year is normally the contestants are there. This time around, plenty of former contestants, but none of the new ones, which kind of makes sense because, of course, you don't know who they are at the time. So you don't know who are the ones to chat to, who's going to be eliminated after the, you know, after the first time. Whereas this time, you know, the ones who'd sort of made a name for themselves in previous series were there and sort of chatting away, and, you know, the plenty of agency types and sponsors.
Any sense you can get of the format evolving? Any changes?
Do you know what? They were hinting that it's more about being back to the food. It's food and chef celebrities still very much. One of the hilarious sizzle reel moments is when Jamie Oliver walks in and one of the contestants basically just flops onto the floor in excitement. Lots of tears, lots of excitement, lots of jumping around. Looked like maybe his thing's catching fire. You know, all of the things you kind of want from the contest. Starts in the first part of the programme is in Melbourne, which is the reason why they did the launch in Melbourne rather than Sydney this year round. And the other interesting thing is, so Sundays at 7:30, then weekdays at 7, which is going to put it head-to-head with The Block on 9. So we're going to see a bit of a battle there.
Yeah. Any sense on changes and opportunities for brands? Obviously, MasterChef is well known for how brands can integrate into the show, the presence of Coles, etc. Any thoughts on how that's developing or
yeah, I did have a bit of a chat to one of the member of the production team from Shine, which is the production company behind it, and it was quite interesting just talking about the process that goes into integration. You know, it's very much, it's not as if you say to them, okay, we can guarantee you, you know, we will feature the brand in, you know, minute 3 of episode 2. But what they do is over time we'll look after you and, you know, tell us beforehand, you know, what your priorities are. What are you looking for to tell the brand story? And she was making the argument that what they don't want is people holding up the product, you know,
so it's in
a clunky way. You know, so they actually want it a bit more subtle. So, you know, the car brand, for instance, did feature when, you know, they're out and about in Melbourne, for instance. But it wasn't as a close-up, it was, you know, but they made sure in the sequence of shots there was one that included a vehicle that was identifiable what the vehicle was, so they kind of cover things like that. But you know, the argument was part of their job on behalf of the sponsor is actually not to make it look clunky, it's to look up, they see that as looking after the sponsor, which is a different approach to you know, to some other programs where, for instance, I think it's probably fair to say that The Block is a little bit more in your face when it comes to, you know, when it comes to that sort of product placement.
Yes, and most importantly, good gravy.
Do you know what? The gravy, well, if you mean by gravy, rather than the actual gravy, the freebies, because I can confirm that the actual gravy was good. The freebies this year, because they've started topping themselves year after year with various kitchen devices. This year it was mainly a trip, but also with a rather nice MasterChef apron, although I'm getting a bit spoiled because I have more than one. But best beef I have ever tasted. And more to the point, what do you think? Is it going to make it? Is it going to be hit this year?
Ratings-wise, I'd say an average show, just guessing, will come in about 1.5 million. But I don't think it will reach the heights of, say, The Block, or certainly not The Voice.
You heard it there. Robin has staked his reputation on 1.5 million. That is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to Robin.
Cheers, Tim.
To the Conversation team. And your podcast producer, Colin.
Thank you.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded and edited at Mumbrella House. See you next week. Toodle pip.
The idea of topping themselves.
Yeah, I did pick you up on that line.